This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Vegetables live in oppression, served on our tables each night. This killing of veggies is madness. I say we take up the fight.
Good day.
Guten Tag. How you doing, partner?
Welcome to I Read the News Today, oh boy.
Or IRTN for short.
That's Stephen Benedetti, an American who's in a permanent resident in Munich, Germany, where American liberalism would be considered center-right politics. Steve is our guest host, filling in for Keith Gottschalk as he works his way with his bookstore in Ohio, the bleeding heart of it all.
And that's Matt Adams. If you can't tell from the accent or the attitude, he's both an American and a Canadian.
And today, we're going to be talking about the Senate. Which Senate? The Canadian Senate and the U.S. Senate. Is either one Democratic? Not really. Then we're going to be talking about secession. Can you take it with you? Apparently not. And then we will be talking a little bit about health care. We have to. The Kennedy bill. Will he or won't we? Does he rule from the grave? And whatever else we feel like.
But first, our feature, Below the Fold, some news you might have missed.
This week, the American Civil Liberties Union joined over 500 organizations demanding that the White House end a program that allows some state and local law enforcement agencies to engage in federal immigration and enforcement activities. The program is called 287G, it's catchy, and the ACLU says, quote, it encourages racial profiling, diverts scarce police resources, and puts everyone's safety at risk. They say, quote, the state and local police should not be transformed into federal immigration agents, particularly through a program known for cursory oversight and insufficient training. President Obama should end the program immediately, unquote. According to the ACLU, since its inception, the program has drawn sharp criticism from federal officials, law enforcement, and community groups because it has led to illegal racial profiling and civil rights abuse, including the unlawful detention and deportation of U.S. citizens, permanent residence. Be very interesting to see if President Obama steps up.
Yes, it will. Anybody been wondering what's going on in Iraq?
Ooh, according to me.
According to the New York Times, President Ahmadinejad is calling for the punishment of opposition leaders who conspired with foreign enemies to protest the elections, while Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has been calling for calm and saying there was no conspiracy. This isn't the first time the two have disagreed, but it is the first time that Ahmadinejad hasn't immediately corrected his opinion to concur with Khamenei's. So what is happening, and why is it happening now? Is Ahmadinejad so secure in his position that he dares cross the Ayatollah? Or are the two of them engaged in some sort of good mullah, bad mullah, kabuki theater, where Ahmadinejad takes the extreme viewpoint, even for Iranian politics, so that the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei can then look like the benevolent leader by taking a more moderate approach? Keep an eye for an eye out on that one.
With the climate crisis, and you know there would be a story there, there are some signs that some areas will get better crops with the rising CO2 levels. But is this all good on the food front? Well, the New Scientist cites a new study published in the journal Plant Biology that looked at wheat grown under the CO2 conditions expected in 2050. The research team found an 8% drop in iron, a 14% increase in lead. Previous studies have shown lower protein in wheat with higher CO2, but cadmium was down, so that's nice. Now pass the pasta.
Okay. Well, as you know, the release of the Lockerbie bomber, whose name I'm not going to try to say, by the way, caused quite a ruckus amongst the chattering class in the U.S. According to the London Review of Books, though, perhaps the outrage should just simmer down a bit. According to the article, it looks like it was not only an act of compassion, but it might have been some shrewd legalistic jujitsu. Apparently, the evidence in this case was so flimsy that prosecutors were realistically afraid of losing the case on appeal. By releasing him now on compassionate grounds, the bomber agrees to drop his appeal, Scotland ends up with a more positive relationship with oil-rich Libya, and they don't risk the scandal of having prosecuted the wrong man. International justice is a strange thing.
And the BBC reported this week that a former Israeli military commander, Eran Efrati, who served in the occupied West Bank, reported to BBC's Kadya Alder that Palestinian youth are routinely ill-treated by Israeli soldiers. Young Palestinians, are mostly arrested for throwing stones at Israeli soldiers or settlers. Mr. Fadi says, quote, "You can take the kid, you blindfold him, you handcuff him, he's really shaking. Sometimes you cuff his legs too, sometimes it cuts off the circulation. He doesn't understand a word of what's going on around him. He doesn't know what you're going to do with him. He just knows we are soldiers with guns, that we will kill people. Maybe they think we're going to kill him," unquote. You can see the link to the full report in our show notes, as well with the other news we've mentioned today, including the last one from Steve.
Okay, Matt. As you know, we had scheduled to do this podcast a few days ago, but there was a fire at a workplace that I was involved with in Kielce, Poland, and it completely messed up my schedule. My third below the fold item was going to be about the then upcoming Japanese elections. Now that they've been held, the news is not really to be missed, but I'd still like to take a second and say a couple of things about it, because it's probably worth paying attention to. The platform of the newly mandated Democratic Party of Japan calls for reevaluating their relationship with the United States of America, which includes the stationing of thousands of troops in Japan, refueling of military ships and planes, favorable trading status, and more. If they follow through on just a part of their promises, it would really mean a completely new balance of power and interests in Asia. Stay tuned.
There we go. So that's below the fold, news you might have missed. You can find the links to the stories you mentioned on our show notes.
There you go.
So there we are. So the Senate and the Senate. These are two things that are driving me nuts.
Well, you in Canada and in America, you got the bicameral set up there, which is something that the Germans decided not to do, which is probably a good thing.
And when did the Germans decide that?
I think when the Americans told them.
Isn't that interesting? Well, yeah, I mean, you know, in Canada, for the Americans there, we have a parliamentary system. Look it up. So yeah, it's sort of like the House of Lords, this Canadian Senate, in the sense that there's this second sort of deliberative body, and just like the House of Lords, it's unelected.
After World War II, the restructuring was pretty heavily influenced by the American Occupying Forces. So at some point, the Americans seem to have thought bicameral is maybe not the way to go.
Yeah, it's a very different structure. The Canadian Senate is a positions of appointment, so the party in power, the prime minister appoints Senate seats, usually of their loyalists. The one advantage that some people claim for the Senate is that you end up with more diversity, more representative of the people of Canada, because the people that get elected, here's a shock, tend to be white men. So the Senate has more diversity, but it's not an elected body. So some people want to get rid of it. Some people don't. The current Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, was complaining about how the Senate's used by, the Liberal Party when they're in power to stack it. And that's what he's been doing and just did the other day. He claims he's doing that in order to bring change. And the fact is the Senate can stop things, just like the House of Lords. And they've been doing it a bit, putting a bit of the brakes on some of the Harper government. He's claiming, well, I'm the government in power, I have the right to do these things. But of course, he's only elected by 30% of the population. So it gets complicated. He's claiming I should be able to run and do anything I want to do because I was elected. But he was elected because we have a parliamentary system and he has a minority government. All that's to say that the Canadian Senate is not democratic. Either is the American Senate. But
one more point on the Canadian Senate. I just want to make sure this is clear. Like, what I've been looking at is that while what he's doing is not to anybody's taste other than his own, he's appointing his cronies and doing it apparently in record numbers in Canada, it's completely within the rules and regulations of the Canadian Senate. He's not doing anything unethical. He's not doing anything against Canadian politics. He's just doing something that he promised he wouldn't do and that he complained about for years before he got into power. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's something to that, he's in no way violating at least the letter of the law, and you can argue whether or not they violate the spirit of the law, he has an agenda. He's very, very good at putting forward his agenda, and he wants to have radical Senate reform, so he wants to stack the Senate to do it. Some people, as I said, like to get rid of the whole thing. Other people want to have it elected. He claims he wants to have it elected, an elected Senate. But then people think, well, then that's the American system, and people are frightened of the American system. But an elected Senate...
Why would they be frightened of the American system, Matt? What could possibly go wrong?
Yes, and I think that's because an elected Senate in Canada wouldn't be like an elected Senate in the U.S. At least I can't believe that they'd want to have a system where the same number of senators come from every province, for example, like every state in the U.S., which is a profoundly undemocratic structure where you have 30 million people in California getting represented by two people, and what is it, 800,000, 900,000 people in North Dakota getting represented by two people. So
but
one
it's specifically
per 400,000.
Set up to be undemocratic.
Yes. Yes, it was. You know. It was specifically set up for that. And the U.S. Senate wasn't elected directly by the people until the 20th century.
Was it the 20th century?
Late 19th, maybe.
Okay.
Very late 19th, maybe, yeah. They used to be appointed by the House, members of the House, and then became elected by the people more directly. But what drives me nuts about the U.S. Senate is that, you know, people claim all these out-of-staters are interfering with our positions, but all U.S. senators have tremendous power over national events. They sit on committees that are national, and a single senator through, what's it, cloture? No, a single senator can block any bill through a procedural techniques.
Anonymous hold. Is that what you were
saying?
Anonymous
hold. That's the word. I couldn't think of it, and I was thinking, what's that word, and how come Steve's not helping me out? And it's because he couldn't hear me. I said cloture, anonymous
exactly.
hold. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Hold. How
Which
does anonymous
you and
hold
I,
work, Steve?
You and I are both unfamiliar with the origin of this, which is something we'll do our homework for before the next show, and hopefully we'll get an answer to where this comes from, because it goes completely against the idea of transparency, which was built into our Constitution, which was built into our government systems. We should be transparent. They should be answerable to us. We should know with whom they meet for healthcare bills or energy bills.
That's right. And so a single senator can stop any bill, which is, you know, so some, you know, nut wing, and there are many of them in the Senate, have unbelievable amount of power. And some Senate reform, I think, in the U.S. is absolutely essential. And you see that with what's going, you know, on now, you know, a handful of people can stop health reform, and we'll get to health reform later. But so... Senate.
Or maybe we should just bleed into it because it's directly related, like this Gang of Six.
All right, yeah. So the Gang of Six is this bipartisan committee that the White House has been supporting of Republicans and Democrats to work out in advance some perceived differences or actual differences on the relationship of the bill. And it seems to have been, in my view, a sort of mug's game, a fool's game, because the Republicans there continue to meet and talk about bipartisanship, and they go out and poke Obama in the eye and talk about death panels and talk about all these different things. And they finally turfed one of them.
Two of the Republicans on the panel are saying that, you know, as long as it includes those death panels, I'm just not going to – I just can't support it. You know, and they were never there in the first place, and it's such a ridiculous
Right, and so it becomes clear then that the U.S. Senate has no interest whatsoever in the Republican side of moving forward, and so therefore the president, you know, eventually just needs to say screw it. I mean, you know, when Bill Clinton's first economic budget went through, it passed without a single Republican vote because the Democrats had a majority in the House at that time. In the House, not a single Republican vote. Just like Obama's had the largest tax cut in history this year in the U.S., and not a single Republican vote. He's not going to get Republican votes on these things, so he should go. But he's being held hostage by the Senate. And the Senate, by people that do not represent the majority of Americans, by any stretch of the imagination. If you look at the majority of Americans and count that out, then, you know, you're looking at New York, you're looking at California, even Ohio, you're seeing support there, you know.
Well, the thing is, you know, so few people that who don't think that reform is necessary. Reform is necessary in a drastic fashion. I know so few people who don't have a horror story related to healthcare. It's absolutely 100% necessary. It has huge popular appeal. It has unbelievable money and power aligned against it.
So what's good, Steve? You're from Massachusetts originally.
Originally. Woo.
Go New England, Patriots.
Yeah. Fight the Bay State.
Yeah, how's the Sox doing this year? No, we won't talk about that. Better than the Jays.
Wild card leaders, thank you very much.
Yeah, better than the Jays. The Jays malaise. You know, Kennedy, obviously, like the senator of probably the 20th century in terms of just sort of stature and power, et cetera, and from the great state of Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Social reform was his big thing, yes.
Do you think now that he's gone, that is that helping the Democrats in terms of who's going to replace him in the Senate, or is that going to hurt him because no one's going to have the power or the charisma or the experience that he has?
There's two or three different factors playing into it. One is they've got obviously one less vote, and the election's not going to be held until January, which probably means February before there's another another person in his place. If they're if the governor, I believe is Duvall, is allowed to appoint anybody is an open question, because Kennedy worked hard to make sure that the governor was not allowed to appoint anybody he wants when Mitt Romney, the Republican, was governor.
That's right. It's a bit of sour grapes and brutal politics, but, you know.
And karma, yeah.
And karma, yeah. They play some hardball politics. Yes, they didn't want a Republican to replace him, but now that it's a Democrat back in power, they want the Democrat to have power. It's a bit weak, but they have the legal right to change the law at any time.
Yeah.
It's hypocritical.
The question is, you know, what if they're going to be able to get away with it or not. But the final question is, you know, I have to imagine it's going to become the Theodore Moore Kennedy Memorial Health Care Bill. And I think that'll actually, my optimistic opinion, you know, me the optimist, think that'll actually help it get through Congress, because he did have great friendships and alliances through his 50 years. No, what was he actually? 45 years in Congress or in Senate. And I think in the balance with all the different factors, I think it's actually going to work towards the bill's favor. Not that I'm saying it's a good thing with the man down.
Do you think there's going to be anything special in the Kennedy bill? Like it'll have extra coverage for alcoholism or something? I don't know. Too soon?
You know the headline in the Onion about 77-year-old alcoholic, overweight Kennedy succumbs to Kennedy curse or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, he was a complicated man.
Absolutely.
You know, and I did a lot of work for literacy when I was doing work for literacy in the U.S., and I always appreciated that. And he did a lot of work for healthcare, and he really fought for, like, minimum wage and such.
Civil rights, Title IX.
And, you know, which is, by American standards, just a stunning record. He also, you know, was, beyond his personal problems, was, you know, like in the Anita Hill hearings and stuff, he was terrible. You know, he didn't step up or anything. So whatever, he's a complicated man. But whether or not, I think he might be right in the short run. I think it could be helpful in the terms of making it sort of a memorial bill. In the long run, the way the Senate works is everything's done in seniority, and all the committee placements are in seniority. And so, you know, he's a man that held a lot of powerful positions, and whoever replaces him does not replace him in those positions. And from the state of Massachusetts, there will be a junior senator. With no experience and no seniority. And so Massachusetts, the power of the state of Massachusetts to effect change, one of the most progressive states, is diminished.
Which is funny, because while they're simultaneously one of the most progressive states, they're also incredibly conservative on so many topics. It's very much a bipolar state.
But civil unions, same-sex civil unions in the state of Massachusetts, higher minimum wage, they tend to support, they don't tend to do a lot of anti-immigration stuff, because half the state's made up of illegal Irish immigrants, you know, historically.
There we go.
Not now, but historically. And people acknowledge that. They say, oh, yeah, my family came over from Ireland illegally, and so there tends to be some sympathy there. Like when I lived in Massachusetts, there was talk about that. Who knows? And the other thing they do, how's this for a segue? They never talk about secession.
Actually, they do.
Do they?
But,
is that when the Patriots lose?
No, it's when the Yankees win. No, there's actually a New England. There's a New England secessionist movement. It's not just Massachusetts. But no, that's a topic that I wanted to bring up with you a while ago. I've mentioned it a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago. I don't know. Because the secession is, since the teabaggers have been bringing it up down in Texas, et cetera.
And they had a rally Saturday in Austin.
Well, see, I missed this due to my work crisis. I didn't see anything about a secessionist rally in Texas. But it's also, you know, this is rooted in Canada, your podcast, our podcast. And there's I don't know how long the secessionist idea of Quebec has been big in Canadian politics. In Europe, there's many various secessionist movements, from the Basque to the Italians want out of the EU. There is then there's like islands of Italy that want to be free. There is a sort of Hitler's ideal of Eastern Austria, Western Switzerland, Northern Italy, and Southern Germany. There's like the talk of them seceding and being a separate country from all of those. So secession is something people, idealists, I think, always want. Because, you know, if we could just rule ourselves, we could do it better.
Yeah, and it obviously has a very long and complicated history. In each one, I like to say that, you know, context is God, or at least my God. Everything changes depending on what and who it is. I mean, in Canada, there's been secessionist movements in Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, Quebec, you know, and in the U.S., you know, Vermont talked about it. There's some cities that voted for it. People that are actually serious about it, I think, are some of the folks in the South and Texas. You know, people will say, well, when Texas joined the Union, you know, we had this agreement that we were allowed to secede at any time. This is simply untrue. They had an agreement that said they could break into, I think, four more
states. Yeah, well, you know, the Supreme Court in 1869, so directly after the Civil War, during Reconstruction or before Reconstruction, Texas versus White, I believe, is the court, is the name of the court case before the Supreme Court, and they said that there is no right for states to secede from the Union. The Union is everlasting, eternal, there's a word they use. In perpetuum, perhaps, but there is no right to secede. There can be armed rebellion. You can't really legislate against armed rebellion, but secession is not allowed by federal law for states to do. Period.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one guy at the rally is like, well, did George Washington care about the law? You know, or maybe not, and that's fine, but let's be honest about it. You know, let's be honest about what it is.
Right, there's a difference between secession and armed insurrection. Those are
right,
two
secession
things.
And rebellion, right? Or and then some people, and I don't really like this word or care for it, but since they're so patriotic there as well, I would say another word for that is being a traitor, right?
No. Right? We must support our president no matter what they do.
Yeah, no matter what our Texas president was. I mean, there is apparently not a lot of international sort of legal action on this around what secession is. Like, there's not any UN resolutions around secession. I mean, a lot of this came up when the Soviet Union collapsed and then people declared independence.
The EU has been looking at it also pretty severely and pretty strongly, and they have some guidelines for what they would recognize as legitimate grounds for secession. It has to do with ethnic heritage, has to do with oppression, has to do with representation, etc. So they're trying, you know, because they're
self-defense,
exactly. So there are, as you said, there is no specific rubric that determines what the grounds for secession are. And actually, I don't think there's anything that determines the difference between armed or between rebellion and secession. I don't know that there's an actual distinction. I don't really think it's a solution for America. That's where I kind of wanted to go with this. I don't think it's a reasonable solution. I don't think that even – I don't know if there's a state that could really sustain itself at this time in this interconnected world that we have. Everybody, every state is so interdependent upon all the other states. Even Texas, even California, those are the two most logical ones that could possibly do it. Or Alaska. Let's not forget the Alaska.
Well, maybe the highly populous states. I mean, California's got a GDP that's like number 8 in the world. You know, they also have a very hegemonic state. I don't really think anyone in California has a desire to separate. And the majority of people in Texas don't either. But for me, one of the differences is the people in Texas that seem to be calling for secession are not people that are subjugated under the state. You know,
right.
These are not
there's no real oppression going on.
Yeah, these are not indigenous people whose lands was taken by the U.S. government in its founding, you know, and they have some of their own nations. This isn't, you know, like in Quebec, which, you know, after a series of wars was sort of jammed in here has been saying for years, you know, we need, you know, and have, you know, their land and resources taken and their language is being taken. And then, you know, and therefore, you know, in the Quebec sovereignty movement, you know, was framed for a while as a sovereignty association. So, you know, they wanted to maintain an economic and union relationships with Canada. And then, you know, there's long and historical issues around sort of what is a distinct society. And then there's questions, of course, about Native Indigenous peoples who were survivors of genocide here. But that's different than saying, you know, I'm some white landowner in Texas and I don't want to pay for healthcare.
Right. I don't want my tax dollars going to help somebody else's healthcare. I want my tax dollars going to bombs.
Right. You know, and I mean, you know, and I, you know, there's rights to self-determination, and that, you know, people in Europe have been pulling out maps for 5,000 years and saying, well, this used to be my land and this used to be my land and blah, 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 blah. In the U.S., it's a little more clear whose land it used to be.
Right, know, there is, like, there's actual written history that tells us when, you know, we, like, took this
we
land.
Know exactly whose land that was, and it wasn't yours.
Well, yeah, so actually, the largest secessionist movement in America is the Lakota Nation. They're trying to do it.
You know, and that,
it's actually very serious. And it has
a chance. It's very serious, and there's treaties, and whether or not you can actually go back to where you wanted to be, you know. That, you know, but there at least is an historical and legal precedence for that based on, like, the self-determination of peoples, original occupation of land, culture.
The right to keep
like
place.
Some, you know, right-wing rancher. I'm sorry. Now, you could say the same thing in Vermont. People in Vermont were threatening to secede when Bush was president. But I think that thing in Vermont, though, was mostly a form of protest. I don't think it was really a serious movement. It was a way to get coverage on their, you know, discontent with President Bush, which might be what they're doing in Texas, but who knows?
It could be, but I don't know. I think that they talk about. I've known a lot of Texans, and there's always this. Well, you know, they've always had this idea that we can move out of the states whenever we want to. It's written into our constitution. It's a myth like Babe. What is it? Big Blue and who's that guy? Paul Bunyan. It's like an origin myth of Texas that they have, and they believe it regardless of facts.
Well, you know, you get that a lot from people that say, you know, that guy that was the protester at the healthcare rally that brought a gun, and he went on the news and he said, you know, President Obama calls himself a constitutional scholar. No, he doesn't call himself a constitutional scholar. The Ivy League institutions where he taught constitutional law call him a constitutional scholar because of his degree.
And his students.
Because of a degree that he has in law. The man that's claiming, oh, well, he calls himself, a lot of these people have never read the Constitution. I don't think.
Yeah, but I don't think so either. But actually, Matt, I'm really glad you brought that up because I think this might be a good point for us to finish for today. We've been having a lot of technical difficulties and I don't want any more. But last week, or last time we did this, I made the comment that this was right after the first person had shown up at an Obama rally with a gun. And I said, can you imagine if a black guy had shown up at a rally with a gun? You know, the guy would be dead meat in 5 minutes as soon as he had an itch anywhere near his gun. Turns out, a black man showed up with an automatic rifle or an automatic weapon at the next rally. So I was wrong in my predictions.
Yeah, but you're right in the larger sense of how people get treated and not treated. But yes. And then a guy showed up with a gun that was like pro-healthcare. I thought, what an American moment that was. Canadians are like, really? And I'm like, yeah, pretty soon they start shooting each other. It's a fine American tradition, you know. The war that...
Well, you know, I don't remember what exactly I was reading or watching when I saw something about rights, about the rights that we have in the Constitution and in the Bill of Rights, etc. And yes, we do have the right to, according to the Second Amendment, we have the right to bear arms. But much like the right to a speedy trial, just because you have it doesn't mean you have to use it. If you never get arrested, you don't need the right to a speedy trial. You don't need to be bringing your guns everywhere. It's simply true.
Well, we can talk about speedy trial another time, but the other thing is that it doesn't say you have the right to bear all arms, right?
No. So you can... And that's the debate I would like to get into with Second Amendment supporters is, you know, it says that Congress will make no law to abridge. Well, they're already conceding that there will be abridgments to it, that you can't have any arm you want. So where is it acceptable for the federal government to start making laws?
Yeah, global thermonuclear weapons, can you have that?
It's a given that the federal government can make laws that restrict that right.
Right, and just so they make laws to restrict speech under libel, under fraud, under perjury. There's all kinds of things you can't say, and there's all kinds of people you can't shoot. And so,
speaking of which, the Minnesota congressman who, or is it the guy running for governor? I forgot which, who said he wanted to get some hunting tags so he could hunt Obama.
Yes.
Did you see that one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Charming.
It is very charming.
But, well, that's the thing. You know, as I said, Americans love their guns, which is why, back to our secessionist theme, the war that killed most Americans, of course, is the American Civil War. So with that and peace and understanding, this is Matt in Toronto for I Read the News Today. Oh boy, not carrying any weapons.
And this is the similarly disarmed Stephen Benedetti in Munich, Germany.
And that's it for this time. And better luck next time with our tech. Take care.
And bye bye.